You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kahn. Thanks for being here. We're getting the latest information on pediatric multisystem inflammatory syndrome. It's a very rare disease. It's associated with the coronavirus in children and teens. And dozens of cases have been reported around the U.S., including some here in Wisconsin. What do you want to know about how the coronavirus could be presenting in children? Has your child been exposed to someone with COVID-19 and now you're concerned about this new disease? Join in 800-642-1234. We have two physicians from Children's Wisconsin Hospital in Milwaukee. Dr. Megan Schultz is an emergency care specialist. Dr. Schultz, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Sheila Hansen is here, a critical care specialist. Dr. Hansen, welcome to you.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Dr. Hansen, let's start with you. Last week, Children's Hospital announced it had identified 7 suspected cases. Can you give us some understanding what this disease is?
Yes. We're still learning a lot about it. It's in the early days, but it's felt to be a post-infectious syndrome, meaning different symptoms in pediatric patients that occurs after COVID exposure. And these symptoms typically start with fever, 3-4 days, abdominal pain. But the worrisome part is there's often some cardiac complications associated with it. Either the heart's not beating right or the heart function isn't correct. But there can be multiple systems affected, which is why the kids end up in the hospital and sometimes in the ICU.
And inflammation in blood vessels as well?
Yes. So it's very different parts, different organs in the body. So the inflammation can be the fever. What's thought is the body when it makes the antibodies. So it's not during the active COVID infection. It's after the body has sort of cleared the infection. The immune system and the antibodies that are created are in overdrive and going after systems of the natural body. So this can be the blood vessels around the heart, the blood's tendency to clot, the heart function, like I mentioned, sometimes some kidney or liver issues as well.
Dr. Schultz, we know fever has been talked about. What are some of the other symptoms?
Yeah, so fever is definitely the symptom we see the most often. It's been reported in 100% of the children we've seen in the United States with MISC. So that's definitely the most prominent symptom, usually for 3 or 4 days, as Dr. Hansen had said. Probably second most common is the GI symptoms, so abdominal pain, vomiting, diarrhea, nausea. And then we also see a lot of rash in kids. The rash is pretty variable. Sometimes it's itchy, sometimes it's painful, can really happen all over the body. But those 3 symptoms are the main ones we're looking for. There are a few others that we've seen that are a little less common, like red eyes, swollen or red lips and tongue, swollen and red hands and feet, cough, headache, lethargy, even sometimes some hallucinations or altered mental status.
We are talking with Dr. Megan Schultz, an emergency care specialist, Dr. Sheila Hansen, critical care specialist. We're looking at pediatric multisystem inflammatory syndrome, or MISC, and how it may or may not be related to COVID-19. Join in with your questions about it, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Hansen, there were 7 cases. Can you tell us what the status is of those cases? Have those children recovered?
Yes, all of our cases have recovered, which is pretty typical. Like you said, this is a rare disease, and most children do quite well. Some are not hospitalized. Those that are hospitalized often are just a day or two. There is a small proportion that can have some serious complications and end up needing ICU care. There have been several deaths worldwide. So that also brings us concern that even with the best ICU care. But in general, it's a disease that with the right support, you're supporting the organs that need help, the body will recover and the children do just fine.
Have there been any more cases since those 7?
So the cases are defined as either confirmed or suspicious because some of the lab confirmation takes a while to come back. Mm-hmm. And so my unofficial count is a few higher than the seven. I'm not sure how many of them will end up being confirmed as MISC.
Dr. Schultz, at what time should parents and caregivers take action if they think they're seeing symptoms? When should they call their pediatrician?
Yeah, that's a great question, one we get often in the ER. You know, we're heading into the summer season when there's a lot of other viruses besides the coronavirus out and about. So, you know, enterovirus is one specific virus we see a lot of that also causes GI symptoms and rash and fever. So it can be tricky. I think just in general for parents to be aware that this is something we're seeing more and more now in the United States, and to be in close contact with your pediatrician. If your child has, you know, more than 3 days of fever and any of the symptoms I outlined before, as far as abdominal pain, vomiting, diarrhea, rash, just give your pediatrician a call. Many of the lab tests that we do to screen for and assess for the multisystem inflammatory syndrome can be done at the pediatrician's office. Of course, if your child is very ill, such as, you know, altered mental status or lethargic or, you know, you're concerned they might be in shock, then of course come to the emergency department and we'll do those same tests in the ER.
Dr. Hansen, we're seeing emerging cases around the country of this syndrome. 32 children appear to have MISC in New Jersey. Are you watching the trends around the country?
We are. And the world of pediatrics is actually known for sharing because we have such more small populations and of disease than the adults. So at these other centers, New York, in Ohio and in Detroit, they're rapidly publishing their case reports. They're putting them on listservs. What do the patients look like? How are they doing? What labs are they checking? And so then each group can then combine that with what's going on locally and come up with the best strategies to screen for these patients, take care of these patients, and monitor their recovery.
A tandem question. Michael from Racine emailed us this morning, wants to know if there have been international reports of the illness and how physicians in other countries are handling it.
Yeah, and that's where it first came from. So the UK is probably the most one that's been disseminated or spread the most. Their cases, I think they had another 30 or so patients where when they put together their hospitals. And they found that about 3 to 4 weeks after the peak of the respiratory COVID, there seemed to be this unusual pediatric peak, which turned out to be the multisystem inflammatory syndrome. And they published and shared with us on different webinars through the CDC the results of, again, what their children looked like, how they were treated, and what the outcomes were.
Do you feel like you know what to watch for? You know, kind of have a handle on what you should be looking for?
Yes and no.
Okay.
When you put the whole worldwide numbers together, they're still pretty small.
Mm.
So when you're trying to look at really specific stuff and things that may not present classically, no, we don't have a lot of information about that. But we do have a lot of this is what we call supportive care, taking care of organs that aren't working well, like the heart or the lungs or the blood clotting system. We have experience with that. And so that gives us a great advantage and we can and help get the kids through this.
We're talking about multisystem inflammatory syndrome, or MISC, with a pair of physicians from Children's Wisconsin Hospital in Milwaukee. We have emergency care specialist Megan Schultz, critical care specialist there Sheila Hansen. What questions do you have about MISC? What do you want to know about symptoms and treatment? Does your child have a weakened immune system, and are you concerned about them being susceptible? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're learning about multisystem inflammatory syndrome, or MISC, with a pair of physicians from Children's Wisconsin Hospital in Milwaukee. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last week, the hospital identified cases of MISC, the rare inflammatory condition, in children and teens that may be associated with the coronavirus that causes COVID-19. What do you want to know about how the spread of MIS-C is going and the risk? Are you keeping your children out of activities this summer, out of precaution? Are you taking their temperature more often? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. We have emergency care specialist Megan Schultz and critical care specialist Sheila Hansen who stay with us. Let's take a call now. Deborah is joining us from Madison. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I'm just curious to know, when do you identify the difference between a child that just has hand, foot, and mouth disease, like the Coxsackie virus thing that kids pass around in daycare centers and all that, but the symptoms sound almost identical until they get really severe? At what point do you decide this is not just hand, foot, and mouth, this needs to be seen?
Deborah, thank you. Dr. Schultz.
Yes, thank you for your question. So this is part of the really difficult situation that we're dealing with, both as parents and as physicians. The novel coronavirus is novel, so we are all learning about it really all over the world. And how to differentiate the symptoms of MIS-C from, like you say, a very common virus like Coxsackie virus or hand, foot, mouth is pretty tricky. So what we would do as physicians is a number of laboratory tests, blood tests, to really assess for this diffuse inflammation that Dr. Hansen had mentioned. So your typical Coxsackie virus or hand, foot, mouth, for those parents who may not know or those listeners who may not know, that really causes kind of like a blistery, ulcerated rash within the mouth, on the hands and feet, and sometimes the diaper area. Very common in daycares, as the caller said. However, that does usually, 9 times out of 10, does not cause the systemic inflammation. So things we're looking for as physicians would be issues with the clotting systems, like Dr. Hansen said. We can do lab tests for that. Issues with the heart, inflammation of the vessels around the heart, lab tests would tell us that. So as a parent, I would say, if your child has a rash and 3 or 4 days of fever, I'd call your pediatrician. To clarify, I think by definition, there's now CDC definitions and WHO definitions of MIS-C, and by both organizations' definitions, this is associated with the coronavirus. So you either have a positive PCR test, you either have a positive antibody test, meaning you fought off the illness and you are now you have antibodies against it, mm-hmm. or you have a positive exposure in your family. So this is definitely associated with coronavirus. And to differentiate between MIS-C and other viruses, usually need some lab tests to be done.
Let's bring in another question. Sarah is with us from Columbus with a question related to Kawasaki disease. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. So I'm a mom of a kiddo who had Kawasaki back when he was about 3. I also teach third grade. So hearing the statements about, this is like Kawasaki's kind of freaked me out, because that was a really ridiculously scary point in my life as a parent. So I'm wondering, does that also, I'm thinking back to how his glands swelled up and, it looked like he had half a grapefruit stuck on the side of his neck. Is that something that's showing up at all? And then has gamma globulin also been used with this or not?
Dr. Hansen?
Yes. So there is a lot of overlap and similarity between Kawasaki's disease or some of the features of Kawasaki's disease and the MIS-C. So sometimes kids will get the one-sided swelling of their lymph nodes, in addition to the red eyes and the rash. I think and they have the persistent fever, which is kind of the hallmark of Kawasaki. So some of our workup is the same, the echocardiogram to look and make sure that the coronary arteries around the heart are healthy and not dilated. And some of the treatments that are being used are similar. So the IVIG, which is the immune globulins that we give to Kawasaki's patients, are frequently given to patients who have the MIS-C, depending on the degree of inflammation and what the specific symptoms are. So there is overlap, but there are some differences in that the COVID-related MIS-C, there's some laboratory things that are a little bit different than Kawasaki's. The markers of inflammation, such as ferritin, are very high in COVID, and more normal to slightly high in Kawasaki disease. And there's some other kind of technical differences between the two at presentation.
We're talking with Dr. Sheila Hansen, a critical care specialist at Children's Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Dr. Schultz, Megan Schultz, an emergency care specialist at Children's Wisconsin. You can join in with your questions as we look at MISC, multisystem inflammatory syndrome. Are you concerned about your child? And what questions do you have about symptoms and care? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Schultz, your hospital created a task force to look at MISC, and it seems as if there are multiple specialists needing to work on these cases as you talk about cardiology and infectious disease and rheumatology. What will this task force do?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. There's many different teams needed to assess for this disease, as well as sort of figure out what to do, how to treat them, and how to report them appropriately. So the task force right now, we are doing chart reviews of patients who sound like this, trying to really diagnose this correctly and accurately. We are developing plans, essentially. So when a patient who could have MISC shows up at their pediatrician's office, what does that pediatrician do? What labs do they order? What's the next step? When the patient shows up in the ER, what should all ER, you know, providers do for that patient? Just so we sort of have a systematized plan of attack, if you will. And similarly with infectious disease, rheumatology, cardiology, we have the hospitalist service as well. So those kids who aren't sick enough to need the ICU, but can just stay in the regular inpatient wards, we really want to make sure we're all, you know, aware of the same research and working toward the same goal to get these kids excellent care.
What do we know about the spread, how contagious it is?
Yeah, so because it's associated with the coronavirus, the child was actually contagious much earlier. The cases that we've seen, the children had no symptoms of coronavirus themselves, so they may have had a family member who had symptoms. So they would be more considered the asymptomatic from the COVID virus itself. And then post-infection, when the inflammatory system, after the antibodies have formed, kind of goes haywire, that's when they get sick and they're no longer infectious now. So the best way to avoid MISC is to avoid getting the COVID exposure.
We know that COVID-19 disproportionately affects people of color. Is this true in what you're seeing right now for MISC, Dr. Schultz?
Within our hospital, no. Our patients with MISC have sort of been representative of our patient population in general.
And Dr. Hansen, what would you say to pediatricians out there as they do receive patients and they are looking at so many different illnesses and issues each day and trying to figure out when they should order tests and how they should go about making sure that they don't miss something?
It is scary, right? Because we're coming up upon the GI season of vomiting and diarrhea viruses, which often present often fever and abdominal pain. So the pediatrician has a hard job. And so that's one of the reasons why we're trying to come up with guidelines that each individual person doesn't have to review the literature and come up with their game plan. And then, of course, we have a lot of specialists available to help. So if there's any specific questions or a consult is needed, there's lots of resources here at Children's. I think this is in the pediatric community, people are aware of it and will probably be more worried than we may have been last year about somebody coming in with 3 days fever and some pretty bad belly pain. But that, I think, like Dr. Schultz said, we're getting to know this complication, and as we get more information, we'll be able to share it.
What can parents do on their end to make sure that they're doing all they can to keep their child safe and healthy, Dr. Schultz?
I mean, as Dr. Hansen said, the MISC itself is not infectious, but coronavirus is. So I really just urge all families to be really careful this summer. You know, wear a mask, wash hands, avoid touching your face, avoid large gatherings. This is not, unfortunately, going to be the summer of, you know, big weddings and concerts. And so even if your child is asymptomatic from coronavirus, which is great, just because this is a novel disease we're still learning about, like, we didn't know MISC existed just 6 months ago. So I would just be really, really careful as a parent. You know, avoid the coronavirus and you can avoid MISC.
Well, thank you both for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Dr. Megan Schultz, emergency care specialist. Dr. Sheila Hansen, a critical care specialist. They're at Children's Wisconsin, a pediatric hospital in Milwaukee. Coming up, we talk with a protester and activist from Milwaukee about the demonstrations against police brutality in our state's largest city. Tracy Dent co-founded the Milwaukee Coalition Against Hate. We'll be back with him right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A quick note here on programming. Join us tonight at 8 for a conversation about how racial and cultural trauma affect communities of color and what support, treatments, and preventative measures are needed. The special is called Call to Mind, a spotlight on Black trauma and policing. That's this evening at 8 on the Ideas Network. Right now, we go to Milwaukee, where news outlets are reporting dozens of businesses have been looted, vandalized, or torched in recent days. Police have fired tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse crowds in recent days. Drivers following protest marches have driven onto sidewalks and lawns. Angry demonstrators have thrown rocks, bottles, shattering shop windows. And the rage and resentment sparked in Minneapolis after the death of George Floyd has fanned out across the country and world, spawning peaceful protests by day and also lawlessness at night. Are you participating in the marches? What is it like being on the ground and part of this movement? We're at 800-642-1234. Tracy Dent is co-founder of the Milwaukee Coalition Against Hate. It's made up of local residents, city leaders, organizations, and businesses focused on ending racism, prejudice, and inequalities. Tracy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the peaceful protests and the marches that you're seeing, the people, thousands of people coming out for these marches. What do you think about the messages?
The message is that, you know, they're marching for Floyd, but also the pain and suffering and the anger that that they're having here in the city of Milwaukee with the Milwaukee Police Department. And they're just tired. You know, and I'm watching this. And one of the things that is so amazing is that they're marching in, like, probably in the thousands. I'm not a good, you know, just an educated guess. But this is like the largest marches that we ever had since the civil rights movement. And the organizers, they are very professional when they're controlling the protesters. You know, it's just amazing. And it's a warm feeling that this is like the younger generation who actually is taking a stand against the injustice and the racism and the hatred that's going on, not with just the Milwaukee Police Department, but just in general. You know, Milwaukee is labeled as the most segregated city in the country. So, there's so many different factors that's going on and why they're marching. And it's so amazing to see that it's a diverse crowd.
And maybe that is what feels different to you this time, that this movement is different because it is younger. And there are people who are coming out from all walks of life.
Yes, yes. And, I keep telling people, because I've been there and I've observed, because I'm very observant, the night mayhem has no association with the peaceful protesters during the day. Because if they was related, then they would have done something during the day also. And I know that the goal of the organizers to keep it peaceful. Don't tear up the vandalize, looting and stuff like that. They don't believe in that. They just want justice. They want to be heard, you know, and it's just that, you know, they are denouncing it. I'm denouncing it. Those people that they need to leave, they need to stop what they're doing and not be part of the, you know, the movement itself. If they have a hidden agenda to cause havoc, you know.
When you look down the streets, and I saw you on the streets in the Harambe neighborhood earlier this week, and you look at the destruction, what goes through your mind?
Anger. Not anger towards the police, but anger towards those people who did this, this destruction. You know, and I always say, you know, and it's crazy because, like, you're marching for justice, but at the same time, you're destroying your own community. And I always say it like this. You're sending mixed messages, mixed signals. Are you saying that we need to destroy our own community to get justice? That's a question mark, you know, open-ended, because it's like, it doesn't make sense. It does not make sense why you want to destroy. And it just angered me, because you're going toward a different direction of the message. The message is that we're tired of being harassed. We're tired of being killed. And I'm talking about, you know, those racist bad cops, you know, and, you know, by destroying property, looting has no association with the movement and the goal of what we're trying to accomplish as a community, and even just worldwide, because now I see there's protests all over the world. And it's amazing how, you know, Mr. Floyd himself ignited such unity across the world.
We're talking with Tracy Dent, co-founder of the Milwaukee Coalition Against Hate. We're looking at the thousands of protesters who have joined together to march for days now and hours to demand justice for George Floyd and others killed by police around the country. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Have you joined the protests? What is the message? What are the next steps? And how is policing in your neighborhood? What does it feel like? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Tracy, as you look at Milwaukee Police Department now with the protesters and their response, how would you judge what they're doing when they are pushing back protesters or controlling the crowds?
To me, it's like a double-edged sword, because you have those agitators who are provoking the police department. And I've seen it hands-on recently the other day when I was on 6th and McKinley, and I seen some of the protesters throwing objects. You know, it could have been bottles or whatever, but I just know they were throwing objects at the police. So the police started making a move towards everybody to disperse. And I guess the protesters wanted to go downtown that direction, and they would not let them. But then after so many things, you know, they decided to start using rubber bullets and tear gas to disperse the crowd. I got caught up in that because I was filming when I was doing it. I went Facebook Live, just watching the protests and everything. You know, and it's like, it's crazy because that the people, the agitators have a different agenda, it seems like, trying to create havoc, trying to create violence, and, you know, amongst the police and the protesters. When the protesters and the organizers saying, hey, we're doing a peaceful protest, a peaceful march, and we don't want, you know, havoc. We don't want violence. Because that's not the message. The message is that we're fighting for justice. We're fighting for Mr. Floyd. And that was the clear message that they, you know, why they are marching. Because if it was any other thing, you wouldn't see all those people in thousands. You wouldn't see thousands of protesters. They all on the same page, but those agitators have a different agenda.
When you got caught up in that moment, what went through your head?
I was telling people to get back, you know? It was more of a lot of different emotions, excitement, panic, and just trying to get clear. Because when they started shooting the tear gas and the rubber bullets, I started running. Somebody ran into me and knocked me down, and then that person fell down. But then it's just, like I said, it's just, you know, I like to say it comes with the territory. Because when you see police officers and the National Guard lined up next to each other, and it was about like over 100 of them, of the police and National Guards. And then they have the Humvees and all their heavy equipment. You know something. They're there more than just keeping the peace. We're going to disperse them.
How do you feel about the National Guard in your city right now?
I say it's needed. It's sad, but it's needed. Because Milwaukee, like I said, this generation never experienced this type of protest before, this type of march. And everybody is overwhelmed. I mean, the organizers of the protest, the police, even the regular citizens of Milwaukee, which are caught in the middle. They feel like they're in the war zone, because, you know, even though they want to support, they don't want to get involved in the march itself, you know. So it's like they just want, you know, they want it to end. That's basically, they want all this stuff to end. Some residents, elderly residents had told me.
I bet elderly residents that you talk to in your neighborhood feel a lot of pain right now.
Yeah, they say they understand. And they're proud of the younger generation taking a stand against police brutality, injustice, racism, and all that. So they was trying to tell me stories about, you know, back in the civil rights movement and how they marched and stuff like that. But they just don't like the looting. They don't agree with the vandalism of buildings and stuff like that. So, yeah.
We're talking with Tracy Dent, co-founder of the Milwaukee Coalition Against Hate. We're talking about taking to the streets to express anger over the George Floyd death and police custody and seeking accountability in policing. Are you part of the protests? Have you turned out for them? What is your message? Should racism be declared a public health crisis? How do you feel about police relations in your neighborhood today? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Tracy Dent right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In Milwaukee, Wednesday, protesters spoke out against police brutality for the sixth consecutive day in the city. The African American Roundtable published a list of demands co-signed by dozens of civic organizations and community leaders, calling for the protection of protesters, reduction and accountability in policing, and stepped up funding, more money for public health services. Are you hearing substantive ideas on how to address concerns with racial injustice? What are your ideas for change, and how do you see them in action? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. We have Tracy Dent, who co-founded the Milwaukee Coalition Against Hate. He stays with us. Let's take a call now. Rodney is in Peshtigo this morning. Hi, Rodney.
Hello. I'm wondering why if the looters are such a minority, how come the protesters ain't controlling them?
Well, the thing is that, and that's a very good question. And I wish I had the answers to that, because the looters are doing this like at 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, And then the organizers, they end their protest maybe about 8-9 o'clock at night, and then they just go home. And then the agitators or whoever that's doing the looting, you know, they're taking it upon themselves. They are well organized, because I was actually at a spot here in Milwaukee at a local Walgreens where I saw them. It was a 24-hour Walgreens, and I saw them run in, run out with stuff. You know, so I saw firsthand them looting, and then someone drove up by me, right next to me, and asked me, "Where did we go next?" And he, when he realized that I wasn't part of their little group, then he drove off. So it's well planned where, you know, those looters, they was well planned of where they was going, you know, how to do what they was doing and everything. So that is not part of the actual protest itself. You know, these are just agitators. These are, you know, people that does not, you know, does not stand for what we're trying to accomplish.
And you're seeing a total dichotomy, the peaceful, concerted protests during the day, and then yes, something else completely happening at night. Let's bring in Patrick now in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Patrick.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I just had a quick comment. You know, I was listening to an interview on NPR, I believe it was yesterday morning. They interviewed Amy Klobuchar about what was going on. And
U.S. Senator. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They followed it up with, you know, one of the questions was about Officer Chauvin and her time as a prosecutor up in Minneapolis and how she addressed some of the issues with police officer violence and racial violence while during her time in, at their position, and what action she took. And her response was, "I was just doing what was normal at the time." And I think it's important to remember, especially now because she's a potential vice presidential candidate, that that wasn't normal at the time. We're not talking about 50 years ago, about 40 years ago. We're talking about just a few years ago when she was in that position. Racial violence is not something that's okay 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 15 years ago. You know, within most people's lifetime here, and we're still seeing it. And our elected officials, regardless of either party, what they say, what they're actually doing and the actions that they're taking to help, you know, eliminate it, just aren't what reflective of what they're telling the people in general.
Patrick, thanks. I want to get Tracy to jump in here with a response.
Yeah, and he's correct. It's not okay. It is not okay. No period of lifetime that, you know, oh, we just that was just the end thing, and this is what we just did at the time. No, because that's just not right. And see, here in Wisconsin, there's the governor and one state representative is crafting a piece of legislation to hold more accountability to the police officers. And then there's a state senator who used to be a former police officer, and his response to the craft of the piece of legislation is that it's this. He's saying that, oh, this is written by some liberals. So why? See, that's the problem. That's the problem with elected officials. They put politics over people's lives. And that's where the elected officials, excuse me, lose focus. You know, he's more worried about his politic and his position in politics versus trying to understand the piece of legislation. Stop putting a label on stuff and say, let me be part of it. Of this piece of legislation, let me give my input versus denouncing it and just saying, oh, it's a liberal thing. You know, that's what's wrong with America today, because we're putting politics over people's lives.
We're talking with Tracy Dent, an activist in Milwaukee, reflecting on the protests against police brutality and systemic racism, and what happens next, with your thoughts as well at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Jeremy now in Racine. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I want to talk endgame here. Once the movement starts to die down, we have elections coming up. We need to get people engaged more locally with their mayor elections, their alderman elections, judges, everything. Majority of people in communities and districts rarely get out to vote for those elections. They're always about the governorships, the federal level, but they don't engage in local elections that have a more profound impact on their everyday life than the federal and state does. And that's where change really starts to begin, from the bottom up, so to speak. I mean, that is truly a grassroots thing. Most people in my neighborhood don't even know who their alderman is, and that's a sad fact that goes on all over this country. People are not engaged locally enough to make any sound changes.
Jeremy, thanks. Tracy, go ahead.
Yes, and Jeremy, you are totally correct. We need to, you know, as community leaders, even elected officials, and the thing is, it's funny, it's like I said, it's a double-edged sword. The elected officials really don't want to educate the public, you know, because when it's election time, everything goes out the window. It's about winning. It's not even about the issues. It's about how to win the race, and they go any length to win. Low voter. They even use the COVID-19 as, you know, a weapon towards the election so they can win, because they know that is excuse me, the elected officials already has a base of voters. So when you have a low voter turnout, most of the time they will stay in office.
Tracy, now, let me ask you this, and I want to interject because we're short on time. But yeah. Lay out for us, what are next steps here? What can people do proactively? What will you be doing proactively?
What needs to happen next? The march is still needs to happen. But at the same time, it's time for the elected officials, the police officials, also community leaders. We all need to sit down and discuss what does change look like and craft something. And then present it to the community, because we need the community input on this so we can start moving forward in a positive way, and also start building and bridging the gap when it comes to community and police relations. It's going to take all of us. We need to listen to each side and work together and work on those solutions and stay on top of it, because as racism, injustice is a constant, the solution has to be a constant. It has to go hand in hand all the time. It's not going to happen overnight, but we have to start somewhere.
Tracy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Tracy Dent, an activist, co-founder of the Milwaukee Coalition Against Hate, focused on ending racism, prejudice, and inequalities. Just ahead, we spend the hour talking about grief and how it's evolving amid the pandemic. We'll talk with those who've lost someone because of the coronavirus. Join us to hear those stories. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.